Hey listeners, Lex on the Decks here. Before you get stuck into this episode of Hot Girls, I wanted to let you know about something else you may be interested in. Though Hot Girls in its podcast format isn't releasing new episodes any longer, if you head over to my Substack, which is lexonthedecks.substack.com, you'll find more interviews and insight on gender minority artists and how to overcome any barriers to entry. You'll also get the opportunity to sign up to my weekly newsletter, 5 Good Things. This is an email letter which will land in your inbox on Fridays, sharing 5 of my favourite cultural or creative discoveries of the week. You'll find all that on lexonthedecks.substack.com. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy this episode of Hot Girls.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome to Hot Girls with me, Lex on the Decks. This week I am joined by a fellow podcaster and a fellow DJ, Farah Nanji, aka Ninja, who got into electronic music kind of as an escapism. We talk about how Fabric was her entry point, which I was super jealous of because my entry point to clubs was not that cool. We talk a fair bit about identity and how music and motorsport, her other great passion, has helped shape her identity. So I really hope you enjoy and find this interesting. Also worth noting that Farah has done a TED talk, the holy grail of speeches. So we also talk a little bit about how she landed that top gig. If you enjoy this episode, please do give it a like or subscribe, or even better, share with a friend. Without further ado, Ninja on the Hot Girls podcast.
Ladies. Listen up. You're listening to Hot Girls with Lex on the Decks.
We in the mix.
It's fire.
Keep it going. We on fire.
From London for the world.
Let's go in.
I grew up in London. I was actually named after Charlie's Angel, Farah Fawcett.
<Yeah. laughs>
And I think my mum, she didn't realise just how much she was going to be signing up for then with that naming decision, because I basically just went out and became this huge adrenaline junkie. I love risk. I love crazy things. So I guess for me, I was quite a tomboy as well growing up. I was in a really pressurised school as well. And I had quite a difficult experience with the education system. From quite a young age. That basically led me to discovering what I'm passionate about in life, because I was bullied as well as a child, and music was became a huge part of my escape and healing process, particularly playing the Spanish guitar, in school, which I now kind of can see very much that inspires a lot of my music with the Balearic kind of Ibiza vibes and things. Mm. I also kind of found, this other sort of passion that I'm really focused a lot of my life around today, which is motorsport. Just kind of experiencing a totally other dimension of taking out some of my frustrations but more importantly, just having a competitive mind in a different way, because school was very competitive, but this was a different type of, ball game altogether. And obviously a lot about risk and all that as well. And somewhere along the way, about the age of 15, I got diagnosed with this learning difficulty dyspraxia, which almost juxtaposes what I do today, because dyspraxia is all about how children or humans have a delay in how they send motor coordination signals to the rest of their bodies. So it's sort of like people when they hear that, how can you sort of be in two industries that are so inherent with coordination?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking.
But I'm a huge believer in finding your own ways to operate, and the more you do that, you can only get better. You can't get worse. And if you know that you're passionate about it, then there's nothing that should stop you. And maybe the dream has to shift a little bit to what maybe you thought it would be, but that's fine as well. So yeah, that was kind of my childhood, really. A lot of figuring all of that out and discovering dance music along the way, which, growing up in London, obviously really lucky, because we obviously have a phenomenal music scene, and I was kind of sneaking into clubs.
Well, I want to talk about that and talk about how you came to DJing, but just first in terms of both Spanish guitar and also when you got drawn into racing, how old were you when you started those things?
So I think guitar was around the age of 7, so really young.
Super young.
Really young, yeah. And karting was a bit later, maybe around 12, just before I became a teenager.
Because I went to quite a competitive, intense school as well, and I think it's a funny environment, isn't it? Because in theory, you should thrive because there's this certain level of expectation, but it can have the opposite effect where it just makes you feel like you're never going to be good enough. What do you think were the hardest like ages for you personally when you were there?
Yeah, I think it really was like becoming a teenager. I think, you know, there's still a bit more of an innocence pre that, you know, but I think just the teen, because then the pressure really is about, well, now everything is about GCSEs and, you know, it's all like, you know, a process. So I think that was, yeah, definitely some of the harder ones. Before that, it was just, I just felt like I wasn't good at things, but there wasn't any consequence in a way, like, you know, your whole life isn't going to be destroyed because you didn't pass an exam or something.
Which it did feel like when exams suddenly came in, didn't it? It suddenly felt like if you fail at this, you're not going to be able to go on to the next stage of your life. Your life will just stop. I don't know. So then was it your early experiences going clubbing that drew you to DJ culture?
Yeah, so in a way, I've been sort of researching it in a way, like just before I just discovered it through the internet. Like, I mean, I was collecting a lot of CDs. Like, I remember I was like, at the time, a member of Fabric First. It was like £20 a year or something. And you just get all these like CDs, amazing CDs that would just come to your house because I couldn't obviously go to the club at that age.
Because you're from London, Fabric was like your early club experiences. My early club experiences were like the cheesiest kind of one room nightclubs with like carpeted floors.
Yeah, so I did manage, that was the first club I basically ended up kind of going into, and it just changed my whole life, because like coming from that school and thinking that everything was around these four walls, and then like seeing the power of a dance floor, and like, you know, I'd been collecting all these CDs and music for ages, but then actually hearing on, you know, an incredible sound system is like unreal. And also just seeing the people around me who are like totally free, just moving around and just expressing themselves, and like there wasn't any judgment, and it was just so much about, you know, the energy and the music. You know, I just really got drawn to the DJ booth because I knew that it wasn't just about like finding music. I really was wanted to share that and express that as well. And yeah, I guess I naturally gravitated towards that point, and then like my friends became the DJs, and then they let me hang out with them even though I was much younger, but like they let me hang out with them because I think maybe like my music taste at the time was like, you know, kind of similar to theirs, and I just really observed what they were doing for many years. And also being a female as well at that time, because like I remember I only had one friend who was a girl who was a DJ, and it was like the holy grail of London. She was like, you know, the one, and I didn't want to like compete with her or like take that away or anything like that. But then I realized quite later like that, you know, I have a lot to give, you know, music, and I want to share that. So yeah, I really about 3 or 4 years later, I went and took the plunge. Never looked back since.
And what was step one? Were you a YouTube learner, or did you take actual lessons, or was it your friends?
I think step one was really the observation for many years, like just being in that, being allowed to come into their DJ booths and see how they were doing things. Some of the things that obviously, you know, no textbook can teach you is like how to read energy in a room and like navigate that as well, which is obviously a huge, you know, part of being a DJ. So that was step one. And then step two, I was like, you know, maybe because I took a gap year before uni, and I thought, you know, I want to do this properly. Like, is there a school? And I, you know, found Point Blank, did DJ school there. But to be honest, really most of it came from then just putting myself in that environment and then doing it myself and learning and just doing that.
How did your, or has your taste in music evolved? Like, you very quickly were drawn to electronic music, obviously, but has your taste changed over the years?
Now there's a lot more creators. You know, in some ways, some of the stuff I was listening to before, now there's just so much more of it. I was really into like kind of tribal techno, and now there's like, you know, so much of that, and the Burning Man sort of music as well, like the nomadic sort of vibes. You know, that back then I just remember having like 10, 20 of those songs, which was still quite a lot. But now obviously it's like, you know, it's pretty everywhere. Evolvement though, I think, yeah, it's just been as well, like kind of the exposure more to the Ibiza sound as well. So like progressive and those kinds of things. And I did used to be quite into hip hop earlier on, but then I think I just really lasered my focus into electronic music in that way.
So tell me some of your highlights and lowlights of your career as a DJ.
For sure. So I think you know, highlights is just the immense privilege to travel the world and to play the music. And, you know, and I did it for 5 years, like nonstop, just toured every 2 weeks. Sometimes I'd be in four countries at once. And just to play those things that, you know, you really are the benchmark of prestige for DJs like Playda and Pasha, Destino and Ibiza. Got to DJ in a ski resort in Val d'Isère, which was really cool. So just, you know, the highlights really was just having enough talent to be able to be brought out into those places and for people to believe in that, because I, you know, still was quite up and coming, still am. Like, people take that risk and book you is quite a big thing. Also, I did this TED Talk, so that was definitely a highlight, because I did a musical performance around that as well, which was quite cool. But I think the lowlights, I think when you're beginning, it's very pure. It's just about the music and it should always be that. But you don't necessarily realize the amount of politics that you're going to have to face, and the fact some people will be jealous of your success. And unfortunately, you're going to have to make decisions about who you surround yourself with and really try and figure out the intentions of people. And it's sad how much people idolize DJs and artists. Like, it's a bit weird, you know. And success, you know, brings a lot of those people who want that from you as well. And I think for me, navigating a lot of that, particularly at a young age, was really quite a tough one to really like get to grips with how to kind of do that, you know.
Yeah, I hear that. It comes up a lot in conversations that I've had actually throughout Hot Girls, is just the importance of having the right people around you, because there are so many people who may not be as trustworthy as you'd like them to be. I personally don't think it's just a thing of the music industry. I think it happens in any industry, but I think because the music industry and creative industries, it's kind of that intersection between passion and profession. Sometimes it can be harder to make sense of what your relationships are with people if they're sort of kind of in that crossover place. To people who are listening who are maybe DJs who are starting out, who are interested, do you have any guidance on how you sort of built up your, I guess, kind of global network in the early days when you were starting to make those connections in Ibiza or in different places around the world?
That's a great question. I think, and particularly now, obviously, when those networks have been stripped away, as they have been, like on a physical level. Back then, LinkedIn wasn't anywhere near what it was today, right? So that's a huge one. Just trying to just really follow and interact and engage with tastemakers and change makers, and just sort of be on the radar. And, you know, there's so much out there now with YouTube as well. Like, all the keynote, you can just go back to IMS and go on their channel, and there's just so many things coming out. Hopefully, when we do get a chance to go back to like playing music in a live environment, you know, the residencies are a key part of it. So if you can get the opportunity to get residencies, it will be a huge thing, because it's not like something's going to change tomorrow, but you'll realize over time, like, it's like, you know, it's like a net. You're just catching people in, people are coming to hear you. You've got a canvas to really show people what you're about and really make the most of it. And unfortunately, you do have to kind of accept the fact that, like, just playing music isn't good enough. Like, you need to have those skills, like, to go out there, to talk, to engage, to get to buy people into you as a person and as a brand, as an artist. There'll be thousands of other people who can do it, so you're competing against those people as well. So, you know, you've really got to do that.
Yeah, I think that's good advice and very true. We live in a world today where people want to know everything about you, not just the music. So, as a DJ and also someone who produces music, do you have any thoughts? And you mentioned earlier that when you were kind of starting out, there was just one other girl. What's your perspective on why the gender gap is so big in electronic music? I think particularly with producers, I would say. There seems to be more DJs and producers in my experience.
God, it's such a tough one, isn't it? Like, why is it like that? It's such a shame, because there isn't any reason why. There's nothing that differentiates us in terms of our ability or anything. I do think part of the production stuff is, like, you do need to have, like, a really good people around you, because, like, you can make music, but then you need to know how to get into labels and all of that stuff. And maybe those networks weren't there before to support other people to get through to that place. You know, now obviously it's a bit different. I just think culturally as well, like, it just wasn't as accepted. And, like, I've heard ridiculous remarks from people, you know, who just don't believe that women can DJ, which is just absolutely ridiculous. So yeah, I think maybe there's just, like, the people themselves in the industry haven't been so welcoming as they should have been. Or now it's really about consciously going out after and helping other people, like, and being very aware of that. And maybe that wasn't there in the past. So I think those are my sort of initial thoughts onto it.
Yeah. So you've worked as a journalist in the industry as well. Who are some of the people you've met that have been really big inspirations to you?
So my first ever interview, which was like totally in the deep end, was with Pete Tong. So that was like,
you were interviewing him.
I was interviewing him, yeah, for a newspaper in Ibiza. So that was like, my God, you know, that was once in a lifetime, right? That was a great starting point. But then people that I've met and been quite inspired by, I've had a chance to interview some really like interesting people, apart from just artists, but like, you know, artist wise, like interviewed people like Third Son and Roger Sanchez and people like that. More than just that, people who actually build the scene up. So whether it's like restaurateurs, club owners, promoters, I find that's really interesting because, you know, that's really some of the where the house is built, right?
Yeah.
So that's been very interesting to hear
100%.
About.
And then kind of to segue on to talk a bit about your podcast, Mission Makers, you've obviously spoken to a lot of people on that. Who are some of the standout interviews for you that you, because I think it's probably listeners will have their own, it's quite a personal thing, isn't it? What you take from different people and who you find interesting. For you personally, who have been some of the interviews that you've learned a lot from or that you've really had some good nuggets from?
So we're like, we structured it in a way where it's like 11 episodes in a season. So that way we can be really laser focused as well on like the guest and what we really want to sort of extract from that episode. But obviously we just launched earlier on this year, or by the time this comes out, probably it would have been 2020. and obviously it's all a learning, you know, amazing learning process. But I think some of the ones that have really stood out, this guy Enzo, who's a mental performance coach for race car drivers, he was really, you know, his story really struck a huge chord with me. He grew up on a council estate and he had this dream of being a race car driver, and like racing cars is just one of the most expensive sports in the world. You know, you need like close to £500,000 by the time you're like 13, 14, you know, to succeed. And so it was a very intangible dream to him at the time, and just how he sort of, you know, did it and got there. And then, but then when he got there, it was sort of like, well, hang on, actually a lot of this is really ego driven because everything centers around the driver, and like, and he won championships and he realized that actually his purpose came more like he would get much more fulfillment from helping others get to that point and becoming a coach. And also the mental things that you have to go through as a driver are really, really intense. So helping others to kind of navigate that. And I think a lot of the things that he talked about had principles that would easily apply to anyone, whether they're into cars or not. So his was definitely a standout one. And then no biases, but My Sister Was My season finale. And the reason why her episode really stood out to me and why I really wanted her on the show is because our family business is in education in Montessori. And my sister's, you know, devoted her life to creating an amazing sanctuary for children. And she's just amazing at like really kind of creating this space where the foundations, which is so crucial, really, really get harnessed. And something that we talked about a lot was like, you know, our childhood can be a tough one to go into. And we had both, although we were raised in the same house, we both had very different experiences of our childhood. Like hers was actually quite peaceful and quite, you know, harmonious, because her schooling experience, you know, it wasn't too bad. Whereas me, like, you know, it was a completely other side of the spectrum. And so being comfortable and like understanding that you do need to go back to your childhood to really, really like be authentic to who you are today, is a huge thing. And so she talked a lot about, you know, those sort of dynamics, and also it's the key things that she believes, you know, is essential for raising future generations and challenging this crazy educational system, which is obviously being so disrupted at the moment. But the Montessori system is really all about how a child can sort of naturally come into consciousness as early as possible, and by observation really understand what their mind really is, what their mission is. Because she says something like, you know, nature has given us a secret mission, like the nature has really given that to us, and it's up to us to sort of find that, but our parents and our guardians and the people around us to really unlock that secret mission that nature's given us. So I thought that was very profound of her.
Yeah, I love that.
To say that, yeah.
Did you learn a lot about her from doing the interview?
I always feel like when we have conversations about education, I'm always learning so much because she knows so much about all these things. Did I learn a bit more about her? Maybe a little bit, but I do know her super well. So yeah. It was more the content. It was more like the content of what she was talking about that really, you know, just mind blown about.
Yeah. I find that conversation around education fascinating because it's so obvious that there's so many flaws in the system, but how you actually tackle it, I'm not sure. So it's for someone to, yeah, I'd find that fascinating. Someone who has really like committed themselves to understanding that.
Yeah, well, it's also very interesting because the Montessori system was created 150 years ago, but the principles that apply are so relevant to today because the lady, Maria Montessori, she's so forward thinking in her vision. And in fact, I even just came from the school today. We're showing someone around, and it's just amazing seeing like the way that everything's thought about, because in a way you come into that space and it's not about like when we go to school, it's, you know, it's very like, you know, it's all test driven, and it's, there's always like the point is that there's going to be a, you know, you've got to pass this at the age of five to get into the good feeder school, whatever. And for them, it's more about like, let's say even numbers, like before you even sort of count, you feel the numbers, and you know, there's like these specific cubes and things. And so children really like understand through all of their five senses, the concept of numbers or the concept of language, this concept of sound. Even today, she was like, you know, sound in our alphabet, we have 26 letters. So we've got 26 different sounds that resonate with the letters. And so before they even start understanding what the letters are, they understand, you know, a different dynamic of it. I was like mind blown. And, you know, so, and also because, you know, 90% of our brain, it forms by the age of five. So really what happens in your schooling experience up at that point, and your familial, obviously, and surroundings as well, is just so paramount in who you become. So yeah, I was just, you know, definitely very inspired by that conversation.
Yeah, you said, I can't remember your exact wording, but you said she said something quite profound about understanding the sense of mission that's quite innate to you. It's part of you're born with it. Do you think you found yours? Do you have moments where you're like, this is my thing, I'm in my flow?
Yeah, like 100%. Like music, one without a shadow of doubt. You know, there's nothing that can give me as much joy as playing music into a room that has got a healing power of its own to people, whatever journey they're on. I know that, like, you know, I really, like, this is why I'm here to do that, you know. And similar to motorsport as well, like, motorsport's got a different mission. It's more, how can we inspire people to go out of their comfort zones and break their own personal limits through motorsport? And you don't have to be into cars to go through that experience, but it's that, in a way, the motorsport, like Formula One, for example, their whole model is so performance driven. And something I found, like, as a comparative example, which is so interesting, but like, you know, F1 teams, everything is data driven and every single point is analyzed to the absolute T. And that's how change happens then, because you just get, you uncover the weaknesses. Even if, you know, a driver wins a race, they'll go back and dissect every angle, every corner, every line. For example, like a lot of the skills that happen in Formula One are transferable to other industries. And I remember reading about this thing where like some people in Formula One were called into like the NHS. They created a huge wave of change because doctors just don't have a chance afterwards to reflect back on what may or may not have worked in a situation. And instead they're just going to the next thing, next thing, next thing. And they don't realize that actually it might be detrimental to that overall performance by taking that crucial pit stop, because it's, you know, maybe the most strategic decision you make, really. So yeah, I think, you know, mission wise I think, you know, definitely I'm very, very clear that it's music and motorsport, and those are the things that, you know, I really want to leave behind.
Yeah, with this year being such a sucky year for DJs and crowds and club culture, how have you kept your optimism and energy up?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, like, the optimism, I mean, It's almost a disbelief that we're watching it happen like the way it is. It's like, wow, I mean, you know. But then at the same time, I've seen so many producers come online and give back, which I think is absolutely amazing. Like so many amazing top level artists doing production schools, doing masterclasses. And that is, you know, amazing to have that time to learn from those types of people. Also, if you get trapped into a negative mindset of like, this all just is so bad, and like, you're never going to come out of it winning. So if you've got to come out of this somehow winning, like in your own way. And for the music industry, I think, you know, we do know that it's just the whole business model around it is really unfair to artists, and it's it's a very broken system. And so maybe this is the chance that we actually really needed to reset a lot of those things and question and do that. So I hope that this will be a time where that change really gets implemented. How have I kept productive throughout all of it? I've obviously had the podcast, which has been like, you know, quite a lot of work.
it is quite a lot of work.
It's a lot more than what people definitely might think.
Definitely.
It took us 8 months to produce, you know, before we entered into, before we launched season one, you know. So, and we launched it mid-pandemic because it was born before lockdown, but then, you know, it all just sort of had to shift from that point onwards. So, yeah. Podcast and making a lot of music, coming back to the studio, doing a lot of that, learning new things, and also just working on this motorsports venture that I'm currently doing at the moment as well.
The process of making music, and I write a lot, and it's exactly the same with writing, it's quite an isolated task, a lot of it. So in that sense, it's like, well, I'm not missing out on anything being alone in the studio. So it's quite good to get some of those hours in. It's just hard when it's not broken up by anything fun.
Yeah, no, I really miss playing. I mean, I think everyone does. It's just nuts. You know, like, as we were saying earlier, this probably will be the tamest New Year's Eve. And, you know, like...
Yeah, I'll say we're recording this the night before New Year's Eve. And we're both just saying that our New Year's Eve are probably not going to be wild. In fact, they definitely won't be. We're complying by the rules.
Yeah.
Vara, you did a TED Talk a few years ago, which I think is probably... A TED Talk is one of those things that is probably on so many people's goal, to-do list, wish list. Was that the case for you? Had it been something you'd wanted to do for a while?
It wasn't even on my radar. Like, I just didn't even think.
Nope.
I didn't even know, like, think or know I was worthy of being a TED Talker. Like, just like so many people afterwards, like, oh my God, how do you do that? It's on my bucket list. And I'm like, wow, I mean, just never thought about it, you know. It just happened very naturally, very organically. I didn't apply to talk. Somebody approached me, so yeah.
Did they approach you because they knew about how you'd handled your dyspraxia and how you had that story, and how did they know about that in the first place?
They didn't tell me, they didn't give me any sort of like, oh, do it right, make it about this theme or anything. They were like, they'd been following me and what I'd been doing in music and motorsport, and the theme that year about TEDx was about explore, excite, something like that. And they just were like, you know, we'd love you, basically just like, we'd love you to do a talk. Would you want to do it? And I was like, I mean, at first I thought it was a scam. I'm not going to lie. And I thought it was like, how is this possible? Like, what? But then when I got introduced to the organizer and, you know, and then I saw his official email address, I was like, oh, this is legit. then it was really like, you know, and then I was like, well, what do I, because they leave it very much up to you, but obviously with their guidance as well. So in a couple of weeks, let's, you know, touch base and talk through what exactly the theme and the idea is. And it has to be one hook, like, yeah, it can't be more than a sentence. And then build obviously from that. So for me, the idea was quite difficult. Obviously, for everyone, it'll be, you know, not the easiest thing to think about, because there's so much you want to share in a short space of time, and it has to correlate very much to a theme, and it can't necessarily be so much about yourself, but more about the idea. You know, that has to be worth spreading. Mm. So for me, it was like the idea just came because, like, I was the whole lead up, the whole thing was just absolutely nuts, because I had 6 weeks notice to do the talk. Most people prepare for a TED Talk minimum 3 to 6 months, if not a year. Like, you know, it's a very intense thing to do. They get speech writers. I mean, there's all these things, you know, right? And I remember at the time, like, I was like, how does one even go about writing a TED Talk? So I Googled it at some point. And I found like this crazy statistic that people spend 1 hour of practicing 1 minute of speech. So they just say that 1 minute back for an hour, and that's crazy. You know, I just didn't even have the time to do that, let alone write the whole thing.
You're like,
you know,
looking, like, at how much physical time you have between now and when you do it. It's like, there's absolutely,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. So anyway, so then I was like, and the other part about all that was that I was in 6 countries in those 6 weeks. So, you know, and I couldn't just put my work life on pause and just stop all that, you know. Like, it wasn't, that's not going to happen. And I love what I do. So it's like, you know, I mean, I was in Ibiza all of that stuff, DJing. It was like May, you know, season opening, all of that. Yeah, and I just remember like every break I had in the DJ booth, I was like, I'm just going there and just quickly writing down this, writing down that, doing this, doing that. It was just crazy. But yeah, the idea came, I was in Dubai and I was on the way back on the plane and I was really like trying to use that plane ride to like think, you know, about what to do. Because I wanted to touch upon particularly this message of bullying and all those things. And I suppose in a way, I never really, when I got diagnosed with dyspraxia, it just was a diagnosis and there was nothing after that to say, well, what do you do now? It was just like, you'll get some extra time in exams and that's it. And you use a laptop. There was nothing else. So I never really thought about it, you know. Then I was looking at this picture that I'd been on a track day in Dubai and I was in this Formula 3 car and just behind me, there was this sort of like, you know, like the kind of sponsor adverts like behind the car. And it said like, you may have seen on these Tagger watches, it says, don't crack under pressure. That's their hashtag. And I was like suddenly looking there and it just hit me there. I was like, oh, wow. Like nobody really knows underneath my helmet that like I'm actually navigating a lot of complex things to be able to do these coordinational things. And it's the same for music because obviously I also want to tie in music as well. Like I don't want to just use one thing. And that's where the idea came from. And it was like, and then I started thinking about it. And I just remember at the time because like the educational psychologist at the time when I got diagnosed, because my question to her was like, you know, well, here I am in this great school. Like, how did I even get in if I have this issue? And she said to me, like, you've just been basically finding your own ways and rewiring your brain to actually stay in this system of education. And then that was when like I just like sort of like really went deep in myself to think, now reflect back many, many years later and think, well, how did I do that? And that's really where the concept of the talk came. And just to add more pressure, you know, it was in the Philharmonic Hall of Luxembourg. And obviously being a musician, and I was like, I really want to integrate a musical element into all of this, you know, in terms of, you know, actually, you know, sort of playing music. So I asked the organizers and they were like, yeah, you can definitely play. Actually, this will be great. Nobody else is really doing any musical thing. And we're in this Philharmonic Hall. So this is crazy. We should definitely do it. But that means your speech has to be less than 18 minutes because you need to factor that in as well. And my speech already was 21 minutes. So I was like, oh my God, it's quite a lot to cut out, you know? And then on top of that, like kind of, you know, composing a song, getting it all ready to be played in a hall of that manner. And playing dance music in a Philharmonic Hall is not the most ideal scenario because there's so much reverb in the room. Mm. So a lot of things can get lost when you play as well. So even just the kick drum can get really lost. So yeah, there's quite a lot around that as well that sort of had to kind of do.
Had to work out, but it went well.
Yeah, it went well. Yeah, luckily. I got through it.
Do you have any favourite TED Talk?
Off the top of my head, there's that guy, I can't remember his name, but he was the one who talked a lot about the educational system and he challenged it, and it was one of the best talks out there. I can't remember his name, but I do know the other one that I really, really thought was amazing was Brené's Brown one as well, about the power of being vulnerable. You know, there's some of your standard up there sort of talks. But also there was one talk during the one that I went to, and it was by this guy, and I actually remember he really set the bar high because he was like the first person to talk or something. And his story was that he'd been caught up in the Belgian terror attacks, and he's a professional basketball player. His, you know, basketball career sort of stopped that day, and all of the things that have sort of he's had to go through on that journey, and you know, he's now done like triathlons and all these crazy things, but he, you know, his legs got very severed. And so just hearing some of that was like, you know, that's quite a story.
I always find the mindset of athletes some of the most fascinating, because the amount of focus and the amount of things that they have to ask in themselves to commit what they do and to push themselves in the way that they do, I find fascinating. I love hearing athletes talk.
100%.
Okay, just a few closing questions for you. If you could give some advice to your younger self, what would it be?
Slow down.
On the track, off the track.
You know, off the track. Because I think like when you're in your 20s, like there's like this, I don't know, there's like this aura, you know, in your 20s, you've got to make it. Like everybody wants, you know, to be really successful at that age. Well, not everybody, but, you know, maybe musicians, more creatives. You know, everything will happen in the time that it's meant to happen for you. So like, don't worry, because we're going to be here for hopefully a long time, so you'll have all the time in the world to if an opportunity gets taken away or somebody else gets it, then don't worry, because your time will still come no matter what happens. You just have to keep being consistent. I think that's the most important thing, like being consistent. It's not enough having talent, you know, don't rely on that at all, because we're all talented at something, but consistency and perseverance is what's going to really push it through to the next level. I think also the maybe sometimes fear, and I think somebody on my podcast said this really well, which was like the regret of inaction will outlive the fear of action. Yeah, and it was like, so the more we get fearful of doing something, we'll have much more regrets by not doing it. And I think, like, particularly with music, like, in the beginning, I was so, like, I think it took me, like, 6-7 months to, like, record my first mix. Because I was like, this is going to be my, you know, statement to the world. And, I mean, really? You know, no one...
I know, but it feels like that.
You know, yeah, it does feel like that. And but, you know, of course, you just build and build and build and it gets like, you know, it's fine. But yeah, so don't worry. Like, it's, you just got to do it. And like Nike says, just do it.
No, I really like both of those. And I think it's really true. It's like the nicest thing I always think is when you get to a place where you're really comfortable with a skill, something that used to really scare you. And then you're like, oh, now this is just kind of second nature. But it takes hours and hours, and it took everyone that it's second nature to hours and hours. So I used to be afraid that if I wasn't good at something, people who were good would kind of judge me for not being good. And now, not to say like now I'm really good at things, but now some of the stuff that I understand or I'm better at, I'm like, I would never think badly of anyone for being a starter at this. I'd be like, let me tell you some of the things that maybe help me improve. And then when you get a bit better, you can teach me other stuff. Some of those fears you have are totally not legitimate, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you a big reader?
Yes, I do read quite a lot. Yeah, big time.
Do you have any favorite books or books that you recommend to people?
Yeah, for sure. So there's a book called Seat of the Soul, I think, by Gary Zukav.
I was going to say it's something like Zukav, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, have you read it?
I haven't read it, but I've heard it mentioned a few times.
Oh, nice. It's a great, great book. It's really about... I think all of us have our own innate powers, and I think maybe some of us aren't switched on consciously to that. But, you know, we all evolve as well, obviously every day, every minute. And his book really goes into our soul and how it, you know, evolves with those powers that are around us, and the, you know, and energy, really, a lot of energy within it. I'm a huge reader as well of Eckhart Tolle. Love what he says about like a new earth and consciousness and humanity and all of those things. I read some of like those kinds of books, more spiritual sort of books, but then I do read a lot of business books as well. A lot of the books that I'm really geeking out on a lot is actually a lot about the how motorsports can impact business. And a lot of my colleagues have actually written some amazing books about some of the things that they've observed in their time at Formula One. And particularly this guy called Mark Gallagher. He's got a great book about business lessons from motorsport, which if you're interested in the topic, it's a great starting point.
My dad does a lot of sailing and he loves sailing. And I remember him saying to me that very proudly that sailing was kind of detailed as the sport that required the second most amount of like skill, and number one above everything was motorsport in like a whole different level. It's the elite, isn't it? Okay, and finally, just some producers or artists that you're really enjoying right now that people should be checking out.
So I love a lot of the stuff coming from sort of South Africa, like De Capo.
Same. Oh, I'm really? Loving the electronic music that's coming from South Africa, particularly at the moment. I'm like, yes.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really amazing. So yeah, I love a lot of his stuff. I am a huge fan of like Guy J, John Digweed, like, you know, the classic sort of progressive things. And who else? I need to have a quick look because I've been...
Oh, check out your Spotify, yeah.
Yeah. Who are you listening to at the moment?
I'm listening to my favorite current project is, do you know D Jeff?
No, I don't actually.
He's got this new project out called Enlightened Path, and he's from Portugal. Yeah. And I would say it's probably like progressive house-ish, kind of like, it's not Afro house. It's just like a global electronic sound, I would say. And I absolutely love it. Like all of the tracks sound different, but they all very much sound like a project. There's songs on there that I think you could listen to on like mainstream radio, but there's also songs on there that would make total sense in like Ibiza at like 4 a.m. So yeah, I'm loving that.
Nice. I'll definitely have to check that one out. Some of the other people I'm listening to a lot is actually this guy called Seal, and he's like a Tale of Us sort of, he's on there sort of like afterlife. And I think his stuff is cool because what he's doing is he's taking a lot of that, like the Indian instruments and blending that with electronic music, which is quite nice.
Nice. I'll check that out.
Yeah, I love that one. Yeah.
Amazing.
Nice.
Thank you. Farah, where can people check you out and also listen to Mission Makers? Where should people be looking out for you? Are you on the socials?
Yeah, obviously on the digital sphere. Yeah, I mean, SoundCloud DJ-Ninja, that's like where the music stuff is. We do put the podcast out there on SoundCloud, but mainly it's iTunes, Spotify, like, you know, wherever you listen to your podcast, really. And yeah, and then Instagram, I think it's DJ.N1NJA, I think that's the one. I should know that, but...
It's all linked on her SoundCloud.
It will all be linked, always, yeah.
You can always start there and go from there.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for chatting to us and sharing your experiences. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And cheers to 2021.
Yeah, 100%.
Big year of fun. And yeah. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. And we will see you next week. Bye. What up, Lex? We keep our eyes on the prize. If no surprise, good women were destined to rise. Inspiring, celebrating, uplifting the new generation. Some hot girls, you know the vibe. All the